And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Harith Rajagopalan, CEO and co-founder of Fractal Labs. Fractal, based near Boston, is applying new scientific insight in intestinal biology to advance treatments and potential cures for metabolic diseases. Besides being an entrepreneur, Harith holds both an MD and a PhD from Johns Hopkins and got his undergraduate degree in biology from Stanford University. He also completed a fellowship at Harvard Medical School. Harith credits a lot of his success to perseverance and grit. In today's episode, we discuss how important it is to not abandon ideas completely. The rising number of chronic conditions managed by medicine today in the US and the huge gap between medicating your symptoms and treating or curing a disease completely. And here is my conversation with Harith. Well, welcome, Harith. Thank you for joining me today. You're based in Cambridge, Boston, or somewhere.
Thanks for having me. We're based in Lexington, Massachusetts.
Okay. That's my first visit to Massachusetts was Lexington, actually. I was staying with a family friend who lived in Lexington.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about your background. You started your career as a physician, and somehow now you run this company. And tell us how you get to, tell us about your journey. How do you decide?
Sure. So I guess I tell people that I'm a physician scientist, cardiologist, and entrepreneur. And this question about how do you describe yourself is really relevant because I have three sons and they can't agree amongst them how to describe what their dad does. Some of them say I'm a doctor, some of them say I'm a scientist, and some of them say I'm an entrepreneur. And so I get in some level, I think I'm a combination of all three of those things. I never really thought I would be an entrepreneur. I always thought I was going to be a physician scientist. I had a passion for biomedical research from a very early age. When I was in high school in Chicago, I used to have an opportunity through my high school to go and do mentored research at Cook County Hospital in Chicago on Alzheimer's disease and trying to understand the plaques that form in the hippocampi of people with Alzheimer's disease, and what is the relationship between the pathological observation of these plaques and the development of the disease. Mm-hmm. And that really triggered for me a fascination about the interface between medicine and biomedical research, with a particular emphasis on trying to study human biology to the greatest extent possible, as opposed to animal biology. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I just mm-hmm. always have gravitated towards trying to do human biological research. I did my undergrad at Stanford. I studied chemistry and really enjoyed the time there. And one of the things that was really special about Stanford is that the spirit of entrepreneurship is so strong that even if you have a very strong academic inclination, the notion that that can be consistent with entrepreneurship and company formation is so evident just by virtue of the culture that that was something that I aspired to. But I always thought that I would do that from the confines of an academic center as opposed to outside of one. And then after Stanford, I went to Hopkins. I did my MD, PhD, and again, tried to pursue research in areas that were in human biology. So I worked with a gentleman named Bert Vogelstein and Christoph Lengauer on colorectal cancers in humans to try to understand why these cancers develop and what we can do to try to prevent them. And then came to Boston, where I studied internal medicine and then did my cardiovascular fellowship in Brigham and Women's Hospital. And along the way, the things that really ignited my passion were the things that had translational impact that I could directly see. The things that got me most excited in research were the things that I thought could make an impact on how patients' lives were treated with their various diseases. And I saw that from high school through research that I did in college and then in my PhD. And then ultimately spent a lot of time in my cardiovascular fellowship asking what area to pursue that would help me to best be able to apply biomedical research to important clinical problems. Mm-hmm. My father and his brother had type 2 diabetes. As a cardiology fellow, I saw a lot of patients with both type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and really started to ask questions about what can we do to try to help treat type 2 diabetes better? Why are we developing type 2 diabetes? What is the problem and how we're treating it today? What does a new solution need to look like? What do we need to understand in order to develop those new solutions? And one thing led to another, and I found myself starting a company a couple of years later, once I realized that I had a real passion for trying to figure out a better way to treat type 2 diabetes.
So what was the process when you decided to start the company? You mentioned that your father had type 2 diabetes and you're a cardiologist, and yet you decide to, you know, what is the process? How did it get there? If it's not just like 2 days decision-making process, I hope.
No, not at all. In fact, I had an important part of the story is that I had been doing some work with some venture capitalists in Boston who were very involved in company formation and company creation investments in the biomedical space, both on the drug side and on the device side. And through that, I came across this really surprising observation that some companies were trying to tackle, which is that there were certain types of surgery that were originally developed for weight loss that very serendipitously were beginning to demonstrate an incredible, profound, and nearly immediate reversal of type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So the reason that this struck me is because it's so surprising. There is nothing that we learned in medical school or in any of our research that should explain how you can do a surgery on the intestine and then immediately reverse type 2 diabetes. And there was like no intellectual model for us to understand that. Mm-hmm. That's really what got me intrigued. Not only was it the problem of type 2 diabetes where we have 50 approved drugs, but 60% of patients can't get their disease under good control. And in that problem, inherent to it is the fact that we have a lot of things that can lower your blood sugar, but nothing that is actually disease modifying. I mean, imagine, heaven forbid, you developed a pneumonia because of a bacterial infection, and you developed a fever and a cough. If your doctors just gave you medicines for the fever and the cough, you would have no expectation that your pneumonia is going to get any better. And yet you realize intuitively that if you don't treat the infection, then of course your pneumonia is just going to continue to get worse. Somehow we have totally lost sight of that in type 2 diabetes. And when I grew up in the field, the paradigm was lower blood sugar with pharmacotherapy. So we completely forgot somehow and failed to think hard about the fact that blood sugar is the symptom of type 2 diabetes, like a fever is a symptom of a pneumonia.
Right.
And just lowering blood sugar with medicines is not making the type 2 diabetes get any better, mm-hmm. which means that people need to keep taking more and more medicines as the disease worsens. And how many medicines can we expect people to take on a daily basis? Most of my patients with type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease were already on 8 or 9 medicines, and despite their best efforts, could not remember what medicines they were on, what doses they were on, had doctor's visits on an every other week basis where something was being tweaked. It is impossible for any human being, even the most intelligent to stay on top of that level of complexity.
Yeah.
How do we intend to solve the problem in this way? And then along comes this surgical observation, which just hit me like a ton of bricks, like mm-hmm. completely different way of resolving the issue, truly disease modifying. And so the question became, number one is like, can we just do bariatric surgery for everybody? Because it's so incredible. Mm-hmm. And the answer is you can't, because it's pretty invasive. It takes a lot of special training. And the risk-benefit ratio wouldn't make sense for 25 million people in the United States to undergo this type of mm-hmm. surgery. And then the second question that comes from that is, okay, maybe we can't do this for everybody, but can we learn enough about why it's working? Maybe it's teaching us something fundamental about why we developed diabetes in the first place. And then third question is, if we learn enough about it, can we actually do something better than the current standard of care that can be disease modifying, that can be scalable in a way that surgery is not, and which can offer an alternative to just this relentless and incessant escalation of polypharmacy, which is so disheartening to patients and to physicians who care for them, and ultimately not working for society.
Yeah.
So bariatric surgery really was like this unbelievable accidental observation. And working with the venture capital firm where I had closest relationships, we started to look at who was working in the space. Mm-hmm. And we saw a lot of companies that were trying to leverage the weight loss aspect of the procedure. But for one reason or another, I think I was most entranced by its immediate anti-diabetic effect, which seemed to be predominantly weight independent. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, actually, what I'm really trying to understand is, what is it about the surgery that's having this profound improvement in diabetes that's not really tied to the weight loss? Mm-hmm. And when we did a landscape analysis, we saw a bunch of different approaches. There were companies that were developing balloons or other ways of trying to cause weight loss via occupying space in the GI tract or restricting the passage of food mm-hmm. through the GI tract. There were people who were trying to take pacemaker technology to modify the enteric nervous system and the signals there to perhaps induce satiety or to alter glucose control. And there was there were other approaches that were trying to create internal barriers that were altering the passage of nutrients through the intestine. And all of them were initially formed to try to address weight loss, but the scientific exploration of which ones cause weight loss and which ones have some metabolic improvement really led me to realize that there's something really fundamental to the gut mm-hmm. as a regulator of metabolism, as essentially an endocrine organ that we have been missing. And that if we understood it better, maybe we could treat it directly. Mm-hmm. And I know you asked me about whether we can, you know, why I decided to start the company. Mm-hmm. But I think I decided to start the company because it became clear to me that there's a problem caused by modern diets that is causing a change to the lining of the GI tract and to the hormones that it produces that is driving diabetes. And I did not see that there were any approaches at the time that were specifically targeting what I believe to be this really important insight about the root cause of in type 2 diabetes and metabolic diseases. So at that point, the question is, well, okay, what do you do about it? Do you pursue this scientifically and academically, or how do you move it forward? And I can't explain why, but it just felt to me like a company needed to be formed mm-hmm. to work on developing a minimally invasive cure. And that was not a company that I saw in the world at that time. So that's what we did. We formed a company with a mission of trying to develop a minimally invasive cure. Because what we said is, bariatric surgery shows that long-term remission off meds is feasible. The question then is, how do you deconstruct that mechanism and then reconstruct it in a manner that can be safe, disease modifying, scalable, and minimally invasive to achieve similar or even better results for patients, to reduce disease burden as opposed to manage the therapy, manage the disease better? And along that journey, the conviction that this needed to be done took over. Mm-hmm. And that's when we formed the company and I decided to pursue it full time.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rutnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping med tech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So when you say we, it means you and the venture capitalists that you've been working with.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the idea, so in a way, you kind of developed the concept, the thinking kind of together along the way, which helped you secure your first capital probably.
Absolutely. I mean, no one can, you can't, do, it's so hard to think about doing these sorts of things on your own, right? And so one of my, our co-founders was the venture capitalist, a general capitalist who helped think about company formation and strategy and financing and the other things that I did not yet know about, like clinical development, regulatory strategy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then the third co-founder, who still works with me today, is Jay Kaplan. And Jay Kaplan is a technologist and a person with a tremendous degree of operating experience in medical devices. And so the three of us got started on this. And you're right, absolutely. Because General Catalyst helped to hatch the company, they also helped with the initial capital raises and continue to be investors and strong supporters to this day. And that was a really, really lucky position to be in, because it not only was an opportunity, an exposure that led to the insight, but also the initial capital to get started.
Yeah. So part of it is always, I always tell people, it's always good to surround yourself with the right people. When the right opportunity comes, then you have everybody's ready.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You know, I think one of the things I hear is, if you're not sure how good of an idea it is, one way you can tell is the quality of the people who are willing to rally behind that idea. Right. And so you should hold a pretty high bar to what high quality people look like, and then to try to convince the best possible people. Mm-hmm. And your ability or lack thereof to do so, I think, you know, can speak volumes about how valuable it is. Now, that idea may not pan out and not everything that's a good idea works. But the other benefit of surrounding yourself with really good people is that you're going to take it in interesting directions together, maybe in ways that you don't necessarily envision when you're starting.
Yeah. So Fractal, you started this company, what, 10 years ago now, almost?
Yeah, we basically started working on this in earnest in the beginning of 2011.
2011,
And we did our Series A funding in the summer of 2011.
You have definitely successful in raising capital and keep making progress. Seems like this summer has been quite a busy summer for you. You got your close your Series E round and you got your IDE approval. So there's a lot of work going on. And I always tell people, I mean, people always tell me in the life of, you know, 10 years, 9 years of running a startup, be as successful as it is, there's always that moment of near death experience. Have you ever had that experience? And if so, is there something that you can share?
Sure. I think that you're lucky if you only have one near-death experience. Okay. I think that most startups I know have multiple. And the I'll point to one very early on. We had an idea for how this product should work. that we had tested in early animal experiments. And then when we started pursuing it in much more rigor upon the close of the Series A, we realized that the technical challenge of, so maybe to take a step back, what we realized scientifically is that the portion of the intestine called the duodenum becomes pathologically altered by high fat and high sugar diets. And then we realized that if you ablate the duodenum successfully, then you can rejuvenate the mucosa lining and then reverse that pathological abnormality to reset the metabolic signals that were driving insulin resistance and metabolic disease. So our first product, Revita, is a system to ablate and rejuvenate the mucosa of the duodenum. Now, the first idea we had for how to build that product was not going to be safe. And so our very first board meeting after our Series A funding was to say, remember that product form that we were talking about? Like, it's not really going to work out that way. This is how we think this is going to work. In hindsight now, we joke with our early investors about how that felt to them at the time. That at the very first board meeting, we had to make a dramatic pivot in what the product was going to look like in order to make it work. And how that could have been an opportunity for people to have said, oh, okay, fail fast, move on and try something else. But I am so glad that, you know, we'd never really abided by that fail fast mentality. Our view has always been that if the problem is really worth solving, then enough to start a company around and to commit yourself to, then you have to be willing to try to see yourself through very, very significant challenges that may call into question the feasibility of the overall project entirely. And if you just said fail fast, then that may afford you the opportunity to pursue other things, but it may also have the consequence of forcing you to give up on something that could be still feasible if you just committed to it. So we've never been very big fans of the common adage of fail fast.
I think it also takes the grit and the persistence to keep at it. And how do you do that? But before I go back, you mentioned those are your near-death experience in a way that you might not get the support from the board. And but yet you do, obviously, because you're still here.
Well, there was no guarantee. There is no guarantee that you would have had that support. I think that the key is, perhaps, are you asking, you know, if you're asking, like, how do you get this, keep the support of your board through a near-death experience? I think the answer is that you have to be willing to really look in the mirror and understand what's working and what's not. You have to be willing to recognize that near-death experiences are going to happen. And you have to think about how you're going to try to solve that. If you're a chess player, you know, it doesn't matter whether you have sacrificed your rook or your queen. The thing that matters is what is your next move. And so it's important to try to understand and to keep yourself focused on thinking through what are the possible next moves in order to determine the viability of moving forward. So it just so happened that we, while we recognized that the initial approach was not going to work, our experience taught us something that might work instead in a superior way to what we had originally imagined, which we also would not have known had we not gone in and tried with experience. So you have, maybe one way to think about it is trying leads to options. You know, options sometimes, you know, are things that don't work out and then are near-death experiences. other options end up becoming essentially positive call options on success that you may not have seen earlier, or you would not have seen had you not tried in the first place. And so you sort of have to think about A, your next move, and B, what are your options that would allow you to move forward successfully, and then present them honestly to your board in order to figure out what the right next step is.
So in that situation, your next move, we're saying you guys discover a better way of doing it. And then it's a matter of convincing the board that this is a better way, that there's a high chance that's going to work.
Yeah. And I would say, I would tweak that a little bit, which is to say convincing yourself, right? Convincing yourself that in a manner that's rigorous, right? Not just convincing yourself because you want to, you know, because you feel like you need to do it, but convincing yourself because you think it's fundamentally the right thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the board are there as investors and the board are there as strategic advisors. And so I have found that it's also always really helpful to partner with thoughtful strategic advisors who can ensure that that they're holding up a mirror to me to make sure that I'm seeing the pluses and the minuses as well, and to help define the path forward.
I think I like your analogies, like holding up a mirror and be honest with yourself, even though sometimes honesty can be very hard, but I think it's a better route, I guess.
And that's the thing that you want to find in all of the people around you, like the people whom you work with, your partners, your co-founders, your investors. All you want, I think honesty is built on a trusting relationship, but honesty is also a willingness to speak hard truths in order to carve a path forward through uncertainty.
And I also realized that taking honest feedback can be very hard. But we all learn that taking honest feedback actually is very helpful. It's just hard. How do you train yourself to find what is the good honest feedback that is constructive and helpful and differentiate it for somebody who's trying to bring you down?
Oh, that's interesting.
Sometimes some people can't make a difference. And I think knowing what is a good, how to make that decision, like, is this a good advice? This is not a good advice.
Whatever people tell you, ultimately, you have to pass that through the prism of your own experience and your own thinking. And I found that the number of people who are trying to bring you down, as you say, is a vanishingly small percentage of the people with whom you interact. And most people who tell you stuff that you don't want to hear, you know, it's not really because they're trying to bring you down, but because they're saying their truth to you. And you have to then pass it through your prism in order to determine how you're going to reevaluate or not. I think a fundamental challenge that anyone who's charting a new path has is to determine to what degree they're going to be listening to the people around them and versus to what degree they're going to pursue what feels right to them. And I don't have a good answer to that other than to try to, you know, to try to ask you to do the thing that logical people have a really hard time doing sometimes, which is to trust your instinct and to let your instinct guide you in the best possible direction.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard stories where sometimes the entrepreneurs, it's hard for them to get a feedback because this is their baby. But then that, as a result of that, it kind of hindered them from making more progress because, like you're saying, most people are doing it with a good intent. They want to be successful. How do you, I guess, you know, I think it's also personality. Some people are more open about getting feedback than others. And I think oftentimes as investors, people always like to, like, you can see the patterns. What kind of person that you want to work with?
You know, physicians who start companies often have a reputation for not taking feedback well and thinking that they have all of the answers. And I think one of the things that benefited me was all working early on with really good mentors who allowed me to see that there was a lot of things that I did not know. Mm-hmm. And there were fundamental skills, capabilities, experiences that I did not have coming into starting Fractal, because I was coming out of a training program and relatively early in my career. So I think I never really had developed the weakness of thinking I had all of the answers. Mm-hmm. So when people gave me feedback, I felt like I was always pretty receptive to it, because I sort of assumed I had a lot to learn and was committed to trying to be the best shepherd of this idea and company that I could be.
So maybe that would bring me to my next question about, because I think you mentioned about you always surround yourself with a good mentor. What would you give somebody who just started, like your three advice that they should consider when they want to start a company?
There's a lot of advice in a lot of different directions. So let me say that if you want to start a company, think of the most compelling person you can possibly imagine in that field and go and see if you can convince them. And that convince them that what you're doing is worthy. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very good test of whether something is worth doing. When we started Fractal, I remember we went to three leading physicians who were working in areas closely related to our idea. And one of them said to us, "This is the best idea I've ever heard of in this space." One of them literally slapped himself on the forehead and said, "I can't believe I didn't think of this myself." Mm-hmm. And the other one said something also very positive. And so those people didn't know me. They had no reason to want to believe in it. They were very knowledgeable in areas that I was not. Their in early support was absolutely invaluable mm-hmm. for us to get going. And it gave me the conviction that what we were working on was important and worthwhile. So one piece of advice that I would give is go and try to convince the best possible people. Mm-hmm. And if you can convince them and they want to join your team in one way or another, that's a pretty good sign that you're doing something important and valuable. And then my second piece of advice, to build on something that I already said, is recognize that this is going to be a significant part of your life for a significant period of time. So make sure that what you're working on is truly important to you, because you're going to devote a huge number of hours a week for more years than you expect into this project. So make sure it's something that you really care about and are passionate about. And then that passion and the ability to convince great people to be on that journey with you will carry you far.
Wasn't there a saying that if you want to do it quickly, you do it alone, but if you want to go big, then you do it together? And I think diabetes is definitely a space that requires a lot of resources to solve this particular problem.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
And I was saying to you earlier before about not only you're successful in raising money, but you're successful in raising money in a difficult space, and diabetes is even more difficult. And I remember this is like 10 years ago when I met my investor's friend. It's like, "Oh, diabetes, I don't want to touch it." But how do you convince, you know, a lot of investors to be on your side? I mean, before you even have any data.
Well, that's a very good question. I think diabetes is a challenging space, but differentiated approaches to diabetes have proven that they can create really, really significant value. Mm-hmm. So maybe let me give you two recent examples in the device / IT space. Livongo, which offered a behavioral coaching approach to diabetes, recently partnered with Teladoc in one of the largest healthcare IT mergers ever, if not the largest. Dexcom has been one of the most high performing stocks in the entire stock market for the past many quarters, and is now worth, when I last checked, a market cap of nearly $40 billion. So I think that diabetes can work. I also think that each category within diabetes will have winners and followers that may not do so well. Mm-hmm. So I think the key thing is that that our category, which is a new category, and we are a first in class procedural therapy for diabetes, is one that captured enough imagination as a sufficiently differentiated and yet compelling category within diabetes that was worth pursuing, recognizing that it would be a challenging path and not an inexpensive one. But on the flip side, there's, I think, a lot of evidence that newly established categories in diabetes can be very, very valuable.
Yeah, no, I think this is it's definitely, it's about time to find a cure, reverse.
It is high time to find a cure. I think that if you just take a step back from Fractyl and just think about the arc of therapeutics development for diseases, right? 10,000 people are joining Medicare every day, and 25% of them have multiple chronic diseases, not just one. The average number of medicines of someone joining Medicare on a daily basis is 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. We have hit, and the pharmaceutical industry has done a really good job developing drugs, which is their business, to address the surrogate markers and hard endpoints for chronic diseases in controlled clinical studies where they can ensure perfect adherence and compliance to therapy for some defined length of time. That is their business, and they do it very well, and they've been very successful in gaining approval and markets. What we have done as a society is something that's not necessarily inevitable, but we have sort of accepted the fact that we're going to expect people to be willing to and able to take 8, 9, 10 different pills with different dosing regimens on a daily basis, put band-aids on a set of different chronic diseases that they're facing without actually doing anything about the underlying disease that's causing them problems or risk in the first place. That's not a criticism of the pharmaceutical industry. It's just a criticism of the intellectual approach that we've taken towards chronic disease. And I would argue we've hit the asymptote of what we can expect polypharmacy to do in chronic diseases in society, period. How many more medicines do you expect a person to take every day than they're already otherwise taking? I don't think you will find any new patient to take any new drug. New drugs in existing diseases are fundamentally cannibalizing existing drugs in those same diseases. They're not convincing new people to take medicines that were not otherwise taking it. As a simple example, GLP-1 drugs are excellent drugs for type 2 diabetes. A recent publication showed that only 1 in 5 patients is still taking a GLP-1 12 months after its prescription. So what does it matter how great the evidence is for a drug in a controlled clinical study for a regulatory approval or for a label, where they're confirming that you're taking the drug every day?
Yeah.
Right?
Science is always hard.
When only 20% of the people are taking the medicine at a year because some other medicine is taking priority in their life.
Yeah.
So we desperately need to, for society's sake,
yeah,
to be thinking much harder about how to reduce disease burden fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where devices, I think, can really help.
Yeah. Right?
Novel devices that are focused on organ level physiology, mm-hmm. and are hopefully addressed on focusing root cause pathology, can do something that drugs cannot do, which is to change the trajectory of disease in that patient's life, yeah. which, if integrated over enough people, can change the trajectory of disease for society. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In a way that you can't do if, because the second you stop taking insulin is the second that your blood sugar goes back to what it would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
And given all the challenges with adherence and polypharmacy, like, we can't count on that
yeah.
as a viable strategy for society.
Yeah. No, I think that's compliance always really challenging in many of the different diseases and the pharmacy's role. I know that you're now, you got your approval for the IDE. You are on many sites in the U.S. How do you access this site in the U.S. during the COVID? I think that will be my last question before you end.
Okay, sure. We've had to change a lot of our practices and clinical trial execution in order to be able to deal with COVID. And you're right. We just got in May approval from the FDA to begin a pivotal trial in insulin-treated patients with type 2 diabetes. And our aim is to assess not only improvement in glycemic control, but also reductions and or elimination of the need for insulin, which we think is going to be really transformative for patients in diabetes. So we're excited about that trial and its intent. We've been talking to sites and we've been preparing, you know, how do you do a clinical trial in diabetes, in device procedures? You need to select great patients. You need to train the physicians in order to do this procedure. You need to be able to help support those procedures and then ensure excellent patient retention. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we are planning to do by having people from Fractyl fly around and support the study, we've been forced to reimagine. Mm-hmm. And that reimagination is, I would say, fundamentally geographic distribution of people. So we have people all around the country now, and virtualization of our approaches, whether that's a site evaluation visit or it's a proctoring, we're doing a lot of stuff virtually.
Wow.
Or patient visits after after the procedure, we're doing a lot of stuff virtually that we had been intending to do in person.
Yeah, no, I think everybody has to adapt with the new environment we are in, and we need to keep on going. Just need to be creative about how to approach it. So, well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your story and about your passionate in trying to solve this disease. I think that's great work that you're doing.
Thank you, Christine. Really appreciated the chance to chat with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Casper Mossman, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.